This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. We are now in October, that's traditionally known as the spooky season. That means each episode this month will be featuring something a little bit perhaps macabre, something a little bit offbeat, something a little bit different, but definitely something you will enjoy. This week we're going to explore the life of Edgar Allan Poe. Recently, when I went to Baltimore, Maryland, I went to Poe's Magic Conference that was hosted by Vince Wilson and his excellent team. It was a lot of fun and really taught us how to take magic to a different level, thanks to Jeff McBride, who was the guest of honor and led us all in thinking about how to give our presentations a little bit more of serious thought rather than just explanatory patter. Well, that's what the whole conference is about, and something I think that we should all take a little bit of time to think about when we are developing our own presentations. That is, if you are speaking or even if you have music, to spend time on how that you can best put your tricks in your act into its best light in order to emote a good reaction from your audiences. Well, this week we're going to feature stories as told by Vince Wilson as he led us on a ghost tour of the Lord Baltimore Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland, as well as a walk down the street to visit the catacombs beneath the church and to the very burial site of Edgar Allan Poe. And speaking of ghost tours, after our visit with the dead, as led by Vince Wilson, we're then going to Argenta, Arkansas, which is a suburb north of Little Rock, Arkansas, where we will speak with Paul Prater. Paul has his own ghost tour he gives throughout the year in Argenta. And he will give us a lot of tips, advice, and suggestions on how to conduct our own ghost walks in our own communities, should you be so inclined, and how to find all these stories and how best to market it. Very interesting stuff. So stay tuned after we are finished with Vince Wilson for the second half of this week's episode. Some of you younger listeners may not know Edgar Allan Poe or may not have read or be familiar with some of his works, and some of the others of us may not know much about his life other than some of his more famous stories like The Raven and The Telltale Heart. But let me tell you a little bit about Edgar Allan Poe first before we begin our journey. So take a walk with me as I tell you a little bit about the life of Edgar Allan Poe. It is a little bit damp outside as we walk through the cemetery, but that won't bother me much. Edgar Allan Poe was born on January 19, 1809. He died on October 7, 1849, at only 40 years old. He was an American writer, poet, editor, and a literary critic. Poe is best known for his poetry and short stories, particularly his tales of mystery and the macabre. He is widely regarded as a central figure in Romanticism in the United States and of American literature. Poe was one of the country's earliest practitioners of the short story and considered to be the inventor of detective fiction genre, as well as significant contributor to the emerging genre of science fiction. Poe is the first well-known American writer to earn a living through writing alone, resulting in a financially difficult life and career. Poe was born in Boston, the second child of actors David and Elizabeth, or Eliza, Poe. He attended the University of Virginia, but left after a year due to lack of money. In 1827, having enlisted in the United States Army under an assumed name, he published his first collection, Tamerlane and Other Poems, credited only to, quote, a Bostonian. Poe later failed as an officer cadet at West Point and declared a firm wish to be a poet and a writer. Poe switched his focus to prose and spent the next several years working for literary journals and periodicals, becoming known for his style of literary criticism. His work forced him to move among several cities, including Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York City. In 1836, he married his 13-year-old cousin, Virginia Clemm, but she died of tuberculosis in 1847. In January 1845, Poe published his poem, The Raven, to instant success. He planned for years to produce his own journal called The Pen, and it was later renamed The Stylus. But before it could be produced, he died in Baltimore on October the 7th, 1849, as mentioned, at age 40, under very mysterious circumstances. The cause of his death remains unknown to this day and has been variously attributed to many causes, including disease, alcoholism, substance abuse, and suicide. Perhaps we might have a little bit of insight that will be shared with us by Vince Wilson later on this tour. Poe and his works influenced literature around the world, as well as specialized fields such as cosmology, that's the study of the universe, not cosmetology, which is makeup and hair, and cryptography. He and his work appear throughout popular culture in literature, films, music, and television. A number of his homes are dedicated museums. The Mystery Writers of America present an annual award known as the Edgar Award for distinguished work in the mystery genre. Well, that's just a thumbnail sketch, according to Wikipedia, about Edgar Allan Poe. So now you know a bit more about Poe as well. Well, let's walk into the Lord Baltimore Hotel and shake off this rain and hear a little bit about what Vince Wilson has to say about some of the history of the Lord Baltimore Hotel.
Everyone's going, ooh, look, which is not part of the regular ghost tour, so we'll get started with the regular ghost tour tonight. So tonight we're going to learn a little bit about the history of the Lord Baltimore Hotel. Oh, sorry about that. Yes, the ghost tapped the microphone. I saw your hand move very quickly as the invisible specter obviously knocked it out of the way. All right, we're going to learn about the history of the Lord Baltimore Hotel right here in the lobby a little bit. And then we're going to walk down to Edgar Allan Poe's gravesite, where we're going to give him an imaginary toast. What do you think? We're going to bring alcohol? Is it against the law in Baltimore to walk down the streets? What are you guys thinking? All right. You guys are storytelling magicians. You're supposed to use your imagination to project the idea that you have alcohol in your hands. That's right. That's why so many of you have drinking problems. I know. All right. But tonight, we're going to be hearing some of the stories of the ghostly happenings at the Lord Baltimore Hotel. We're going to walk around a little bit, all right? But for the most part, we're going to go to the lobby, and then we're going to go down to the gravesite. It's about two blocks from here at the corner of Green and Fayette Street. But first, the stories of the Lord Baltimore. Lord Baltimore was built in 1928.
All right, the hotel was designed by an architect named William Lee Stoddard and opened on December 30th, 1928. It is 22 stories tall and made in a French Renaissance Art Deco style. It's you know, as you can see, as you walk around the lobby, it has these this beautiful Art Deco ceiling, a chandelier, a grand piano, and we're about to walk into the Versailles Room. The Versailles Room, which will be hosting the conference this weekend, has a very interesting secret inside. When you enter the room, you will see to the left in the back of the room an unusual door. This door, which was covered up only to be revealed just a dozen years ago or so, hid a speakeasy, a real speakeasy. Not one of the modern speakeasies that are tributes to the 1920s, but a legitimate in-secret speakeasy. The managers and employees for years had thought that the windows outside were purely decorative. Little did they know, while doing some remodeling repairs in 2014, they would uncover this hidden treasure that has been in here for decades. Now, it's interesting to note that shortly after the opening of the Lord Baltimore Hotel in 1928, they did go directly into the Great Depression while dealing with the time period in history known as Prohibition. And these two factors contributed to a lot of mysterious happenings here at the Lord Baltimore. Like many hotels in the United States at the time, the Lord Baltimore lost a lot of money from the lack of booze they were selling in the restaurant and tavern. And of course, like many of those other hotels, inns, beds and breakfasts throughout the United States, they had decided to open up their own speakeasies. Speakeasies were usually very small, as you can see. They weren't particularly large. They would hold maybe a dozen people or so in cramped conditions because of the constant threat of being busted and raided and having all their precious materials destroyed by the federal government. Now, on a side note, the Great Depression also contributed to, as the name implies, a lot of depression, sadness. Vast majority of Americans had been forced into situations they were unable to handle, deal with. This is in a time period in history there weren't readily available therapy or help for the people in the United States who were going into this traumatic moment in history where all hope seemed lost because all people that were even moderately good off, well off, and those who were very well off were suddenly at the poverty level. And the Lord Baltimore was a place where many people, regrettably, sadly, lost their lives. In fact, I was very shocked when the Lord Baltimore allowed me to do this ghost tour and mention, with their permission, that over 30 people took their lives here, many of them from the 19th floor, where there is a balcony. Unfortunately, we can't go there tonight, but there is a balcony on the 19th floor, a patio used for outdoor cooking, events, weddings. There's also, for many years, a place where people would take their lives. One of the more tragic stories and most famous stories is that of Molly and her parents. I like to think that when they locked off the doors and walked to the edge, stood on the edge and closed her eyes, that they told Molly she was about to fly. That's the last thought that went through her head. Molly now haunts the 19th floor, and she is a very mischievous and a happy child, I'm pleased to say. She plays pranks on people visiting and bounces her balls, her little red ball specifically, against the walls and floors, almost sounding like she has more than one. People have only ever caught the tail end of her dress and the bottoms of her shoes because she's very fast. And a few blurry pictures have been taken over the years. And with that, I would like the rest of the group to follow me now as we take the 10-minute walk down the street to Baltimore's most famous historic resident, Edgar Allan Poe.
So if you have any trepidation about stepping on graves like this gentleman right here, all right, who's literally walking on a grave, give it up. Don't worry about it. If you're worried about bad luck, you're going to be walking on graves. There's no way to avoid it. All right? You'll be walking on someone's corpse over their body.
That's right. You'll be, if there's any superstition in your family about doing such a thing, it is too late. There are probably people buried in the sidewalk, as far as we know. All right? There's over 1,000 people buried here. All right. Without further ado, it's time for us to enter the catacombs of Westminster. Yes. Watch
and learn as we descend.
Now, this is not really a catacombs. All right? Here's what happened. The original burying grounds used to be at the Jones Falls, now part of the Jones Falls Expressway. All right? The Jones Falls is, as the name implies, a falls. It's near a river tributary that goes out into the Inner Harbor. Okay? And then Chesapeake Bay. Turns out, bad idea building a graveyard near water. When the it's on a downslope of a hilly area too. When the spring thaw would come, you would occasionally see Grandpa and Grandma floating out in the Inner Harbor. So they decided to replace the burying grounds up on a higher ground, and that's where we are right now. Now, at some point, the Presbyterian Church decided we need another church in Baltimore. And they were out of land. Now, if they just waited a few years, the Great Baltimore Fire would have taken care of that problem for them. But they could not, being unaware of this fire about to happen. So they built the church right on top of the existing burying grounds. And that's how we have these catacombs here. Not a technical catacombs, but that's what they call it. Name kind of stuff. All right? Gather around as we hear the legendary tale of Frank the Body Snatcher. That's right. Imagine 220 years ago, at the beginnings of this country, at the beginnings of scientific exploration of the modern era. However, there is much superstition still around. However, science marches on, and the first autopsy hall in America was built here in Baltimore. Davidge Hall. It still exists to this day, two blocks from here. Davidge Hall is a two-tier surgery and autopsy hall for with stadium seating. Great place to have a conference at, if you ask me. Davidge Hall was built for the purpose of scientific exploration. However, the people of Baltimore were not ready yet for such abominable practices as they saw it. The first Davidge Hall was wood construction. And like Frankenstein villagers, they came upon it and burned it to the ground. The original Davidge Hall was no more. But science marches on. And a new one was built, apparently taking a page out of the Three Little Pigs. And this one was made out of brick and stone, granite and marble. And it still stands to this day. And the 10-foot wall around it that used to be there helped keep it intact and keep the superstitious away. Unfortunately for Davidge Hall, you are only allowed by law to have the corpse of one executed murderer a month. But this is Baltimore 200 years ago, not Baltimore today, so there is a little less murderers around. That's my one political comment for tonight. All right. However, that didn't stop the progress of science. They decided they were going to hire people of ill repute to go into the graveyards and cemeteries, the burying grounds of Baltimore, and dig up the corpses of the recently deceased and sell them to the doctors at Davidge Hall. Normally this process would be a long process indeed. Several men would come into the graveyard at night. They would dig up the entire grave, lift out the casket. Well, at first they would throw a tarp or tapestry or something like that onto the grass so that it would look like the dirt had not been disturbed. And they would just kind of roll it back in. But this took 5, 6, 7 hours, even with 3 strong men. And then came along a Frank. No, his last name, Lost to Prosperity. We don't know who he once was. But Frank was able to procure a body in less than 2.5 hours. We know this because a letter was written from one doctor to the next that still exists to this day and is kept in the archives at Davidge Hall, in which it says, "You must simply procure the services of one master Frank, who was able to procure a body in less than a single night." And it turns out it was about 3 hours. Now, how did he turn 6 hours into half that time or less? Well, Frank was smart. Instead of digging up the entire casket, he would send someone out, sometimes himself, and make a measurement approximately of where the top of the casket was in relation to the tombstone. And they would come back later that evening and dig only to the head, a square hole. Then they would take a handy orphan and lower that child down into that hole with an iron poker, and it would bash the top of the casket in. Then a fisherman's hook would be lowered in, a large one for large, like sharks and whales and things like that, would be lowered down and put around the neck. And they would string it up, usually in one piece, and then throw it into a barrel of whiskey. Now, before, they would just roll it in a tarp and throw it in the back of a wagon and take it to Davidge Hall. But that risked you getting caught. You have a body-shaped canvas in the back of your cart. So they were very clever indeed. They would throw it in this barrel and cap it down and roll it down the street to Davidge Hall. And they would take it up a secret spiral staircase that exists to this very day. But why would they put him in a barrel of whiskey? I mean, to hide it, but also to cover the smell. And if they get caught, they could just say, and I always imagine, because I'm Irish, I always imagine if Frank was, "Oh, officer, we're just taking it down to the hospital purely for medicinal purposes, of course." And we roll it up into that staircase. They conduct their experiments. This went on for several years. And then one day, Frank, he was rolling in the dough at $35 a corpse, was thinking to himself, "You know what? We're throwing away all this perfectly good whiskey. Why not rebottle it?"
Oh, man.
"And sell it back to the taverns and pubs in Baltimore." And that, my friends, is where some people believe the term rot gut whiskey really came from.
Or spirits.
That's right, spirits. And that is the story of Frank the Body Snatcher. Thank you. His time travel hat. That's right. We may never know the answers to these secrets. We also may never know the identity of another mysterious figure who has visited the gravesite on many occasions. In the mid to late 1950s, a mysterious visitor started coming
to the Poe gravesite. He would come on his birthday in January 5th, 1909. Remember, Poe is only 40 years old. It's unfortunate that the photographs of him are unflattering. But if you understand how photography worked at the time, it highlights every imperfection. He was actually not that old. He was only 40 years old. 40. That's right. But this mysterious figure would come on his birthday in January in an overcoat, a wide-brimmed fedora, and a cane, even in his obviously younger years. He would visit the grave, put his hand right here, kneel down, and then place three long-stemmed roses across and a half a bottle of cognac. That's right, the good stuff too. All right. Now, it's, no one knows why he used cognac and not like Amontillado or something like that, right? Because cognac is never mentioned in any of Poe's stories, okay? Maybe it's just the favorite of the man who became known as the Poe Toaster, because he would take a sip of that, raise it up into the air, and then sit it back down onto the stone with the roses. This tradition went on until 2004. That's correct. The original Poe Toaster probably passed away in 1999 or 2000, and his son took over. His son apparently was a jerk. I want to be a little blunt with you, okay? All right? He wrote a letter in 2001 kind of outing his not being a Baltimore native. When in this letter, paraphrasing the Mass of the Red Death, and I'm not going to give it any justification or validation, but actually quoting it perfectly, but if you read the end of the Mass of the Red Death, it basically paraphrases it, saying that the Ravens will lose to the New York Giants, which they did not, by the way. Ravens totally, you know, killed it that year, no pun intended. But he became very unpopular after that. And the year following, they actually tried to chase down the Poe Toaster. He did it a few more years again and then quit completely. Currently, the Poe Toaster is an actor, an anonymous one, to keep some of the tradition, but people actually know in management who the Poe Toaster is now. Okay? Before, no one did. He would somehow managed to get into the burying grounds at night, walk through the grounds to here, and in front of eyewitnesses outside the gate, stand right here, leaving the roses and the cognac in place. One year, in 2004, the last year he would ever visit the burying grounds officially, the Poe Toaster left those roses and cognac here. I had forgotten something after doing a tour the previous night, where we may have unofficially had some Amontillado from a cask. All right. So I came back the following morning. I let myself in through the gate. It wasn't even unlocked yet. I was very tired. And lo and behold, here at this grave was the roses and cognac still in place. And I collected those and still own them today. That's right. Now, those roses and cognac, I did ask. I went to management. I said, hey, just asking. Is it all right if I take these? They said, all right, yeah, fine, no problem. And now I own them. So that is the legend, for the most part, of the Poe Toaster. In 2000, I think it was actually the year 2000. It was the same year that Jim Henson passed away. And I remember that because the Poe Toaster was mentioned in Life magazine, but it had Kermit the Frog on the cover. And they actually had a cameraman from Life magazine with an infrared camera in that building over there and a telescopic lens. And the only known photograph of the Poe Toaster, because they keep them from taking pictures outside the gate, was taken right there. And you can Google that. It's on Google Images now. And I actually have a copy of that magazine as well. So you still get on eBay sometimes. And that is our officially, well, there's one more story I could tell you. There's not many ghost stories associated with the burying grounds. A lot of history. But there's one more story. Apparently people have seen the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe at the burying grounds. But you would think, as your images of Poe go through your mind, that he would be morose, melancholy, sobbing or crying or contemplating great philosophies. But no, the ghost of Poe skips through the graveyard, laughing and smiling, because he's finally with those who understand him. And that is the last story at the Westminster Burying Grounds.
And now let's travel from the east coast of the U.S. in Baltimore, Maryland, to the Midwest in Little Rock, Arkansas, where we hear from Mr. Paul Prater. While we're on the subject of ghost tours, I thought it would be interesting to revisit someone that we had in an episode several years ago. And that's my friend Paul Prater, who gives ghost tours up in a place just north, a little bit of Little Rock, Arkansas. And some of you might be interested in conducting your own ghost tours. Whether or not the place is haunted, you probably can make up your own story and try to haunt a place. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Paul Prater. Hey there, Paul.
Hey, Scott, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You bet. Well, you have so much knowledge about this, and you do a lot of shows and bizarre type of things, and you have a great presentations that you give in your shows. And but you bring that all to bear when you do these ghost tours. And it's not just during the month of October. This is something that you do year round, much like Vince Wilson does with the Poe tours. But you do this year round also. Is that correct?
Yeah, what I do is they run for the public during season, but anytime anyone calls and wants a tour, yep, I'll go do them.
So how do they find you then? Let's go back, back to the basics about how do you market that?
Sure. So the way I'm found is primarily through my website. You know, I've just got a good solid website, and, you know, SEO is always an ever-changing thing, but if you type in haunted attractions, ghost tours, any of that, Arkansas, I pop up right at the top. So it's typically out of town people who are traveling in, and that's they Google that, and there I am. Now, during the holiday season, television, radio, Facebook ads. I've even had a radio station last year. People came to the tour and they replayed an interview we had done 2 years prior.
Wow.
So yeah, I was pretty surprised to hear that, because they said, "We heard you on the radio this morning." And I said, "I wasn't on the radio this morning."
But it was interesting enough, and I guess timely enough, that they could present that again. You know, there's something in that that perhaps that people may not realize, that if you don't have something that is of the moment, in other words, you're trying to promote something that's only like for this weekend, you better be there. I'm going to be. But if you make this more generic, they can plug and play that time after time and year after year, I guess.
Right. Because I always run them heavily during September. Yeah. We start at the end of September and run through mid-November. Mm-hmm. And I plug them pretty hard and have really good turnouts during the season. I have found, I've tried to run like regular Christmas time tours, and there just was not enough turnout to make it worth it for me. Mm-hmm. So that's why I just started doing them as you know, if you want a tour, let me know and I'll give them, but I don't market them in the off season. Plus, I mean, you know, being in Houston, it's too damn hot to run ghost tours most of the year.
Yep.
Out there sweating everywhere.
Even in the evenings. That's right. It cools off to about 85, you know. Right. So, yeah. And plus humidity.
Humidity.
Right. Exactly. And what another thing is that what we would do is we would promote this also to meetup groups. There are organizations who have clubs, or they're looking for things to do with their organization that might be interested in seeking out these things. So that's another group that you can find. Just Google some of these psychic meetup groups or spook meetup groups or haunted or gothic or whatever it is. I guess there are certain keywords you can find.
Yeah. And you can do that with your Facebook marketing too. And that's what I do. You know, I select the person's interest to market to. I don't have it just wide open. And of course, that's just one aspect or avenue of my marketing. I know that that mm-hmm. could exclude some people from seeing it. But again, with radio, with television, with all of that, I feel like I get pretty good coverage. And I've been lucky that I have really good numbers on ghost tours. And we're not a tourist town, so they are locals that are turning out by and large during the Halloween season.
I would imagine that's true. In Little Rock, most people would be coming there for the therapeutic waters, I guess. And
right.
whatnot. Yeah. Not,
and that's an hour away from me. So okay. That's a hot spring. So yeah. I do ask, though, everybody who comes on the tour, I ask every single person, how did you hear about this? So that way I get good feedback. I get a lot of, I don't know. Now at this point, I get a lot of, well, so-and-so told me about it. Facebook, though, is still the number one answer. They're like, I don't even know how I saw it. I just saw it on Facebook. Wow. Well, I know how they saw it. It's because I boosted my event so it doesn't look like an ad. And they saw the event pop up. That's how they got it.
Oh, so it's boosting, not advertising necessarily. Because I know I get right. those things also. It says, do you want to boost this event? And it actually works. I've not used that before, but interesting.
It does, because it doesn't look like advertising. It just looks like, I mean, it is something they would be interested in, because I boost it to people who are interested in haunted attractions, ghost tours, ghost hunting, Halloween. So they are interested in it.
So you can identify what groups this would be boosted to, I guess. Is that right?
Yep. You get to choose what kind of special interest. So that's how I do my marketing. So it's not just a wide open blast of everybody out there. It's focused on people who at least have an interest in this stuff. And I do it within, I think, 85 miles of Little Rock.
That's interesting. Okay. So the way that they have their analytics, they, I guess, would send that around to just a targeted area. They could do
that's
that
correct.
Too. Huh, interesting.
Yeah, you can limit your region and your special interest. So I always do that. And I do, you can even select how you... what percentage of you want men versus women to see it, for instance. And I found that most of the people who click through on wide open campaigns are women. So I heavily skew it towards women as well.
Mm-hmm. Good to know. Well, let me go back to the, I guess, very beginning, as far as trying to start a ghost tour to begin with. How did you find the place, and what, how'd you go about that, and sure. the stories and all that?
Sure. I want to give a little shout out to Ed Underwood. He's a magician as well, and started ghost tours in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And he called me when he was moving and asked me to take over. So as far as learning how to do a ghost tour, I give Ed a whole lot of credit. But to answer your question specifically, you know, North Little Rock, that's Argenta, that's my area. So I came up with that ghost tour. What I did, I was sitting on the back patio of a business down there with a friend of mine who owns a wine bar. And he goes, you know, people say there's a ghost up there, and points at a window. Hmm. And it hit me. If there's one ghost, there's got to be more. Right?
Gotta have friends, right?
So I actually went to, we have a historical commission right there in Argenta. That's the name for our old downtown North Little Rock is Argenta. That was the original name of the city. So I went down there and told him what I wanted to do and asked the historian if he had ghost stories. And I guess to a certain extent, I was real lucky. He opened a folder he had kept of ghost stories. Hmm. In Argenta. And then being the history commission, they had all of the pictures I could ever want. And they were very open about sharing those with me. But then to really fill it out, I also went to each of the places, each of those businesses. And I think this is key. If you're going to do a ghost tour, I went to each of the businesses, asked them if they were okay with me talking about their business, which, you know, most people are like, yeah, free marketing, but some mm-hmm. people are weird about ghost stories and haunted stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I asked them what were their experiences. I got stories from business owners about stuff that happened. Those were where most of my stories came from, were actually the business owners or employees who had experienced things in that building. And then finally, you can go to, I think it's newspapers.com, and buy a subscription, and you have access, searchable newspaper articles. You can do a search term. So I did murder, suicide, you know, anything I could think of, and put in the terms North Little Rock, Argenta, the river, found tons of stories. So between those three methods, I've got pretty much two separate tours, an hour and a half one and a 2 hour tour. And most of the stories don't even cross over.
Wow.
There were that many. And this is I'm talking five blocks. This isn't a huge area.
So I was going to say, that's another thing. Whenever that you're going out for a walk, there are some people, let's say older people who may not want to walk as far, or children. I assume obviously you have an age minimum for where you let kids, but you don't encourage it.
Exactly. What I say is, there's stories about murder, prostitution, suicide. You know your kid. I'm not the gatekeeper. You choose if you want to bring your kid, but I don't alter my tour for your kid.
There you
go. Which is not entirely true. I toned down the language if there's a kid there. Not that I'm dropping F-bombs or anything, but, you know,
sure.
I use euphemisms to refer to prostitutes instead of calling them prostitutes, you know, just stuff like that. I don't change the stories, though.
Right, right. But as far as getting to walk around, it's an easy walk. And I assume, again, before you get started, you're telling people, okay, for those of you who are worried about this, we're only going to be walking for about five blocks. It's going to take, what, an hour and a half? Or how long do you typically do this?
Yeah, the typical ghost tours. And I do two different tours. One is the standard just walking ghost tour, and that's an hour and a half. And then I do one called Booze and Brews, where we actually go into the bars and I do some performance in two bars. And that one's 2 hours just because of the bar time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's very clear. It's all in all caps on the website. This is a walking tour. Wear comfortable clothes and shoes. And I do have a fair number of people who ask, you know, how far do I have to walk? And when I tell them it's five blocks, that's it. And we're stopping, you know, five blocks in an hour and a half. You're not walking at a brisk pace. You know, there's plenty of.
That's true.
Rest time.
About how many people do you, I mean, do you cap it, or is there usually about 15, 12 people, or what?
No, I cap them at 25.
25. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that, I found that's as many as I can get. I don't want to wear a microphone around my neck. You know, I think part of being a responsible ghost tour operator is not bothering people. If they're not on the tour, they don't want to hear my mic blaring out
across the street. Anyway, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 25, I can get around me in like a semicircle. And everyone can hear. And with a semicircle, I constantly encourage them, get around me in a semicircle, because we're more compact that way too. So we're not blocking the sidewalks.
I assume you have some people who are walk-ups and they're walking by and they kind of see it's this group and they say, well, it's kind of interesting. And they try to join your group. And do you say, hey, this is a private group, or do you allow them to join you, or what?
That's an excellent question. So if somebody pops up while I'm in the middle of the story, I'm not going to chastise them or anything else. I finish the story. I let them hear whatever that story is. And then I go, hey, these are the Haunted Argenta ghost tours, or now it's Haunted Arkansas ghost tours. I've got flyers. I'll hand them a flyer and say, we run every night, you know, come and check us out.
Mm-hmm.
So that way
the whole tour.
Yeah. That way it's a respectful, but they get the point then when I'm like, this is a paid tour and we'd love to see you here, but you know,
that's a nice way of handling that for sure. You were mentioning earlier about some of the businesses that may not want you to talk about the spook stories in and around their establishment. And I recall when Jamie Salinas and I were trying to find a location for our seances that we were doing, there was a place here in Houston called the Rice Hotel, which was known also for some of the spook stories. It's on the haunted register as well, but they are really trying to downplay that. And one of the reasons is because it's now a condominium and they don't want their people who are the guests or owners to bail out of the contract and say, hey, you never told us this was haunted. You know, things have gone wrong. You know, our pipes broke and it's because of the spooks and, you know, you owe us and we, you know, whatever. So right. It's like, we don't want anything to do with that. So,
right. We've got a beautiful hotel in downtown Little Rock that would be incredible for that kind of stuff. And that was their deal. They're like, absolutely not. We're not talking about this stuff. We're not having any of this in our hotel. And I'm like, man, missing out.
Missing an opportunity there. That's true. Yeah. I know. And others just do the opposite. They will just really embrace it completely. Let's say like a Stanley Hotel there, you know, in Colorado or something. You were talking about the photos and things that you have. Do you bring those along like in an album and show the people on the tour and say, look, this is a picture of so-and-so?
I do. And this is something I learned from Ed too, that I give him credit for, that I think's pretty brilliant. I mean, I guess nowadays you can probably do it on an iPad as well. But there's something I like about flipping those pages. Yeah, it's a three-ring binder, and you just kind of, it's got a long flap. You Velcro it on the other side, so you just slide your arm through it, and you can flip through the pictures. And
oh, yeah.
The other thing that's great about it is, for instance, I'm terrible with numbers, and obviously history dates are important. I'm terrible with numbers, though. So when I flip this thing over, and they're looking at a picture on the backside, I've got my dates and a basic bullet point of the facts of the story. So that way I don't have to try to remember everything. Of course, at this point now, I've got pretty much everything down except for when I add a new story in. But yeah, that way they have something to see that's visual. But I also got two videos from one of the venues we go into that are really completely unexplainable. I mean, some weird stuff going on. And when I do the booze and brews, of course, people are at the bar. Some people are upstairs. So as people come upstairs for where we're doing the seance, I show the videos. So that way it's not just dead time and they get something a little extra that the other places don't. And it is just on an iPad. I show the videos of what happened right there in that place.
Oh, that's a good idea too. Yeah, with the iPad. But I like the idea where that you actually have part of your script that you're seeing on the back. Right. When you flip the thing over like that, that's a clever idea then too. As far as the stories, I'm sure as people are on this tour, many times will offer you stories and say, well, I heard about such and such. Is that true? And say, like, well, it will be next week.
That's right. I have had several of those stories and yeah, I've incorporated them into the shows and I let people know on the, it's true. On the very first tour I did, I got two great stories from people who used to work in one of the haunted locations with their experiences of what happened in there. Mm-hmm. And I always say, that's awesome. Can I share that on future tours? Everyone, of course, says yes.
Right.
And yeah, so you're absolutely right. I've gotten more stories from people on the tours as well who worked in these places or experienced these places. Because again, a lot of my attendees are locals.
I don't think it would take too much research for anybody living anywhere in the world, basically, where you can find some stories about something that had happened in or around your area that you could build upon and tell a story. Even if something had happened miles away, you could still refer to that because it was nearby. But
yeah, I completely agree with that.
Or it could even be, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, about how you can even make up a story, because there was a book by Richard Wiseman in which he was talking about one of the chapters about he had created a story at a bar in a harbor someplace in England about some sea captain or something. And he was a spirit and he kept coming back to this bar and telling these stories. And before long, the stories took legs and they were able then to build upon this, which there was nothing to begin with, but after he told it so many times, it became real. And then other people said, yeah, I've seen this guy, or I remember he had a pirate that traveled with him or something, or, you know, that right. Just kind of adds on to the whole thing. So there's a possibility of other stories that can be made. So if you actually tell a story, you have to be based in history. And I think it's important, right. if there is some tragedy or something out of that, that you can perhaps build a story around the tragedy. Let me also point out, I think it's important that if you are going that route, it needs to be something that will have been more than a generation ago, specifically probably more than 100 years ago. You don't want to do something that is still an open wound in some people's lives who have family who may have been involved with that, and they don't want to hear about or talk about, or they might know details that you're trying to flesh out that is complete BS. So it's right. Important, I think, that you would have a separation of time of something that had happened that people probably don't know about. You know what I mean?
I agree, because there would be a story that would be great for the tour, but that's exactly the situation. Something that occurred about 15 years ago, and that's, yeah, no way.
Right.
I know
right.
Some of the people who were involved around that. I'm being vague intentionally, but sure. People who were, and I certainly would not want to offend them. So yeah, I totally agree with you. It needs to be way in the past.
Right. Right. And in doing this, you have a rain or shine, a rain check kind of a policy, or what do you do?
Yeah. What I say is that unless it's going to be absolutely miserable for everyone involved, we go. The good thing is, because it's all kind of downtown area, there's plenty of awnings and big awnings because they're old, you know, old buildings. So they have those mm-hmm. awnings that wrap around the building that are blocks long. So there's very little time where we have to be actually in the rain. Mostly it's just a 2-block walk. That's about it. And the whole rest of the time there are awnings. And I tell people, bring umbrellas or ponchos. I mean, I'm in it too. Now, if it was absolutely just howling wind and, you know, rain blowing sideways, which has happened occasionally, I will cancel. You know, I'll either give refunds or accommodate them, move them to a different date, or run an extra tour.
One other thing, do you have jump scares? Do you have companions or people behind a trash can or something?
I don't. And I make that clear from the get-go that I don't do that. But the funny thing is, while I don't do that, it happens fairly frequently. I mean, This is an area where people know who I am. I mean, when I'm doing ghost tours, I get people yelling out the car door at us because they know, like I say, it's an area where I spend a lot of my time when I'm not doing ghost tours. There's lots of restaurants and bars and it's just my area. It's yeah. where I live, you know? So there are plenty of people who will come up behind a group and yell boo at them. It's not me though. And I tell that at the very start, I say, this is, you know, this isn't a haunted house. No one's going to jump out and yell boo. Said, if that happens and you're angry, I had nothing to do with it. If you loved it, I'll claim all the credit.
Good way of putting that. I mentioned that because there was a tour I had gone on in Ireland, I believe it was. And they were taking us down this particular alley after they had been talking about the Jekyll and Hyde. We'd gone to the Jekyll and Hyde bar and then we were going around. Anyhow, I remember someone jumping out from behind a trash can that was in costume from back at that period. And my wife just about fell to her knees screaming, you know.
Yeah.
I've never seen her react like that from before.
The best thing that I ever got as a reaction, I was telling this story. We're at the back. Usually the path we're on is very well lit, but we were at the back side of the buildings off Main Street. And it's dark back there. And I'm telling the story about how a guy committed suicide at the base of the stairwell and the wind stirs up and a plastic bag came out of that stairwell. And man, people screamed as if I had done something. And it was just the wind stirring up a plastic bag. So
the right moment, the right time. Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, any other tips or ideas or suggestions as we close here as to for people who might be interested in trying to start their own ghost tour?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one thing that people need to be aware of is think about your walking. Where are you going to walk? Make it a good path that's walkable. Think about parking. Where are people going to park? And just make sure that the city is cool with it. Getting buy-in from the city and business owners, I think, is really key, because then they start supporting you and backing you instead of fighting you.
That's a good idea. And also maybe align with the Convention and Tourism Bureau, so that way they know about you as well. What about insurance?
I don't have insurance. And the simple reason is this: we are walking on public streets, on city streets. They can try to sue me, but if somebody falls and hurts themselves, I'm also an attorney. So I'm not quite as worried about that. But if they fall and trip and hurt themselves, I mean, it's not my venue. It's not my area. And I'm not giving that as legal advice. I'm just answering your question as for me personally.
Right.
There are a lot of ghost tour guides who have insurance, but you know, I think somebody would be hard pressed to be successful in a lawsuit. Anyone can sue you for anything.
That's
true. And you're going to have to hire an attorney, but you know, I am one, so I'm not quite as worried about it.
There we go. And for people again, who want to take a look at the website, where can they go to find you or what your website looks like?
Yeah, it's hauntedarkansastours.com. So if they go there, they can find everything and they can look at, I've got a pretty thorough fact there that covers a lot of questions that you asked. So people can kind of look at that, see how I've got things structured. I feel like it lays most of the things out. And part of that is because I get tired of, you know, calls and questions about the same things over and over again. So I try to put everything on the fact to handle it, but you know, you still get the calls.
You still get calls. Indeed. Well, thank you for taking this call and for filling us in on some of the details then as well. That's great. And good luck with and continued success. How many years have you been doing this?
This will be the sixth year now.
Okay.
So it's done really well. COVID years accepted, of course.
Exactly. Well, Paul Prater, thank you again for being my guest. Right.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you. Talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. So the next time, that was Paul Prater. Scotty out. I want to thank my guests this week, both Vince Wilson and Paul Prater, for giving us not only a tour, but also how to give tours. So that was very enlightening and a lot of fun on so many different levels. You might have also noticed there was a little difference in the tempo when we did the tour with Vince Wilson of the Lord Baltimore. Unfortunately, and for some unknown bizarre reason, we were unable to capture the live audio at the time when we were at the Lord Baltimore Hotel, and so I had to contact Vince afterwards in order to capture that part of the tour via phone. So I apologize for the audio quality not being as good as I'd like for it to be, but then, of course, as you realize, we picked up on the street, and you also got to hear all the ambient noise from the rest of the group on the tour, as well as the street sounds and whatever else was going on if you listen carefully in the background. And also, I do want to thank Paul Prater for coming back and being my guest again. He has been a guest in the past, and I would encourage you, if you've not heard him speak before, that you can go back and listen to the episode that we recorded. In episode number 526, we recorded and broadcast in October of 2019. Well, we're going to continue our walk out of this damp cemetery and get back to dry land soon, and we'll be presenting another great conversation with an epic conjurer next week, someone who we haven't perhaps heard from before on this podcast. He was someone who also was at the Pose Magic Conference as a featured speaker, and someone I know that you will enjoy. It was quite an interesting conversation that we have, and if you subscribe to the pod letter, you will know who that person is going to be. If you don't, then I suggest that you go to themagicwordpodcast.com and sign up for the pod letter. And we will tell you from week to week who is on that week and who's coming up next week, plus a suggestion from the archives of someone or ones you may have missed. So thank you very much, all you guys and ghouls, for joining us this week. And until next week, stay well, get booked, and keep it real. Or should I say, keep it unreal. This is Scotty out. Ha 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 ha!